Hey, Misfits. I'm your host, Melinda. Thank you for joining Mystery Loves Company. Now hold on to your butts as we go on another mysterious adventure. Let's see what today has in store for us. Hi, Misfits. Melinda here. So today we are going to talk about the mysterious tragedy that is Cindy James. Now, this story is, I mean, it's crazy. Like, there's 50% of people think that she inflicted all of this upon herself, and 50% of people think that this was inflicted upon her. And so, I mean, this all happened back in the 80s, and this is still like a head scratcher for people. It's still an unsolved mystery as to what actually happened to Cindy James. So let's go ahead and get into the story. Cindy was a 44-year-old pediatric nurse in Vancouver, Canada. She disappeared May 25th, 1989. She grew up in a household where she had her mother and father and five siblings. So there were six of them damn kids. She had three older brothers and two younger sisters. She attended high school in Ottawa, which is the capital of Canada, due to her father being in the military. And she also had recorded in her private diaries that her childhood had been marked by her father's strictness, which included corporal punishment. So as an adult, Cindy went to nursing school. And her dad reenlisted in the Air Force, and so the whole family relocated to France except for Cindy. She stayed, but she would go visit them on holidays, and she would write to them. And during this time, like, she was writing letters to her family, and in these letters, Cindy occasionally referred to an unnamed intern she had met during her studies. She claimed that the two had at one point been engaged, and that after finding he had terminal cancer, the man committed suicide while the couple were on a skiing trip. But the interesting thing about this is nobody knew who this man was. Like, she never said his name. She never said, she never said anything about him other than she knows this guy, they're engaged. Nobody ever met him. Nobody knows if this man is real. Nobody has a clue. So then, in 1965, Cindy met Roy Makepeace. He was a psychiatrist, 18 years her senior. They married in 1966, which was the same year she graduated nursing school with her BSN. Good for her. After they had been married for a while, Cindy made accusations of spousal abuse. Roy rebutted with he had only slapped her twice. Friggin' prick. There's no spousal abuse. I've just slapped her around a little bit. Whatever, it doesn't make any sense. Anyway, I digress. In 1982, Cindy finally left Makepeace. 4 months later, Cindy's own personal hell began. So, during a nearly seven-year period spanning between 1982 and 1989, Cindy reported approximately 90 incidents of criminal activity to the Royal Canadian Mounted Police, which is known as the RCMP. Her claims included alleged acts of stalking, vandalism, arson, harassment, intimidation, home invasions, and physical assaults perpetrated by an unknown person or persons. So we're going to get into these alleged claims, and I'm going to try to not go super into detail on all of them, but I'm going to get pretty detailed on a lot of them. So just be prepared for that. In September of 1982, she told her friends and family that she was afraid that someone had been lurking around her home. Obscene phone calls started coming in, and in October of 1982, the phone calls consisted of an individual speaking in different voices. On some occasions, there was mere silence. on the other end, and Cindy described some of the calls as sexual and violent in nature. On October 11th, Cindy received a phone call consisting of loud breathing noises, and the following day received another call in a menacing whisper which said, "I'll get you one night, Cindy." She reported the obscene calls to the RCMP, who visited her home and suggested she keep a list of each call and its contents, as well as an unlisted number. Shortly after the officer left, Cindy received a call in which an apparent male voice said, "You fucking bitch, I'll get you." The next day, on the afternoon of October 13th, the caller threatened her, "So you think you can call the police and the police will keep you safe? You wait. I've got my zipper open. I'm talking to my throbbing," before she abruptly ended the call. 2 days later, Cindy reported to the RCMP that she had heard something lurking outside her home and had awoken in the morning to find her porch lights smashed. On October 15th, she reported to the police that someone had thrown a rock through one of her windows and entered her home, though nothing else had been disturbed. 4 days later, on October 19th, she reported that someone had entered her home and slashed the pillow on her bed. So now we're going to get into talking about Patrick McBride, who goes by Pat. He is a very important person in this case. And at the end of this episode, I've got a juicy little snippet. So let's just get into Pat really quick. Pat was an officer with the Vancouver RCMP. He suspected it was Cindy's ex-husband, Makepeace, but Cindy contradicted herself when she told authorities that she didn't think that Roy was capable of tormenting her, while also telling friends and family he was violently abusive. The next-door neighbor told McBride that she herself had witnessed a man standing outside Cindy's home on at least three different occasions and watched him walk through the front gate on one occasion. The neighbor insisted that the man did not resemble Makepeace. At this point, Cindy and McBride begin a relationship, and McBride moved in on October 31st, 1982, which is about 2 weeks after Cindy reported her incidents to the police. McBride was planning to stay for 2 weeks to help keep an eye on things. Well, that 2 weeks turned into a year. In November, McBride reports getting suspicious phone calls as well. Later in November, Cindy finds a note stuck to her car windshield with a picture of a corpse lying under a medical sheet. On November 28th, McBride found the phone lines outside of Cindy's house had been cut in five different places. And McBride moved out about a year later, but this stuff continued the whole time McBride was there, so he wasn't scaring anybody off, right? So, Christmas of 1982, Cindy finds a note outside that says, "Merry Christmas," with a picture of a woman with her throat slashed and stained in red ink. In 1983, Cindy's friend and coworker stopped by Cindy's house and knocks on the door, but there's no answer. So she assumed that Cindy was probably in her nightly bath and then turns to leave when she hears something, and she goes into the backyard and sees Cindy lying unconscious with a charcoal-colored nylon wrapped around her neck. When she regained consciousness, Cindy told her friend that she had been attacked from behind while walking to her exterior garage, and that he brought her into the garage where another man waited, and the two men strangled her. She alleged that the men inserted a knife into her girl bits and threatened to kill her younger sister, Melanie, if she reported the attack to authorities. Doctors who examined Cindy after the alleged attack found no concrete evidence of sexual assault. Detective Bauer, I'm sorry, I'm going to kill this name. Detective David Boyer Smith remained doubtful about her claim. At police request, Cindy was asked to see a psychiatrist, but she declined, as she feared doing so would stigmatize her. Instead, she agreed to visit a general practitioner with experience in counseling. On February 1st, 1983, Cindy moved. Under a week later, she received a note that said, "Run, rabbit, run. I'll show you how fucking good I am. Soon, bang, bang, you're dead." Soon after that, she moved again. The notes and the threats continue. Cindy painted her car and changed her name, but it didn't stop. So, she ends up hiring a private investigator. His name is Ozzie Caban. And on January 30th, 1984, Caban overheard strange noises on a two-way radio he had given Cindy, prompting him to visit her home. Upon arrival, he found her laying unconscious in her living room with a paring knife stabbed through her hand and a note pinned through it. The note, which was crafted with letters cut and pasted from a magazine, read, "Now you must die," and we'll just say, "See you next Tuesday." Cindy was taken to a local hospital and, in an interview with Caban, stated the last thing she remembered before being found was witnessing a man coming through the gate of her property before he assaulted her and bludgeoned her over the head with a blunt object. She stated that once incapacitated, she recalled her attacker inserting a hypodermic needle into her arm. Doctors located a needle mark in the right arm, but found no traces of any drugs in her system. So Cindy took a polygraph test after the incident, which showed no deception. However, the officer that conducted the test later stated that the results, by his estimation, proved inconclusive. So let's just talk about a polygraph test really quick. They're not 100%. And if you get someone who's frazzled, like, to their core, of course, there's going to be inconclusive results in this. So sometimes polygraph tests work in our favor, sometimes they do not. I'm not sure how exactly I feel about a polygraph test, but I digress. We will move on. So Constable Keo Ikoma, who reported to Cindy's residence the night of the alleged attack, stated that he observed blood smeared in a circular pattern on the kitchen floor, as though someone had attempted to clean the evidence. Between October and November of 1983, Cindy discovered the remains of three strangled cats in her garden, each bound with rope. There were also multiple fires that were set at Cindy's house on multiple occasions, none of which actually burned her house down, but there were fires, and sometimes the fire department had to come out and put them out. So on June 18th, she phoned Caban in a panic, and he rushed to her home to find her cowering in the garden, claiming someone had broken into her house. Caban discovered her dog Heidi cowering in the basement, sitting in her feces, along with a note reading, "Happy Birthday," alongside sexually explicit photos. Heidi, the dog, had been physically abused, and Caban noted that the rope that was bound around her neck appeared to be the same discovered on the dead cats Cindy had found in the previous autumn. On the windowsill in the basement was a cigarette butt that he discovered, which did not match the brand that Cindy was known to smoke. Based on the physical abuse Heidi had endured, Caban concluded that Cindy could not have been the perpetrator, stating she'd never have done that if she was the Cindy I knew. Over the following several weeks, further calls were received, one of which Caban answered at Cindy's home while she was at work, and a dead cat was found lying in the stairwell of her house. On July 1st, Cindy told Caban two men had arrived at her front door posing as police officers, but fled when she radioed Caban. On July 23rd, Cindy claimed she was attacked by someone in nearby Dunbar Park while walking her dog at approximately 8:30 p.m. By her recollection, she was attacked by a man with a beard driving a green van with a female passenger. Several hours later, at around midnight, she was found in a dazed state attempting to enter the home of a neighbor and had a dark gray nylon stocking around her neck. Her dog Heidi was found by Caban wandering in the area of the park. She was taken to the nearby University of British Columbia Health and Science Center, where doctors observed two puncture marks in her right arm. While Cindy was being treated, a hospital receptionist told authorities that a man with an accent had called the front desk inquiring about the hospital's security policies. When police played audio of Makepeace's voice to the receptionist, she felt there was a strong possibility it was the same person. In October of 1984, while under the care of a hypnotherapist, Cindy recounted a repressed memory of witnessing a double murder, but did not divulge further details. In January of 1985, while under hypnosis, Cindy told police she had witnessed her ex-husband murder two men, then dismember their bodies with an axe while the couple were vacationing at a cabin on Thormanby Island in July of 1981. According to Cindy, Makepeace smeared blood from one of the victim's severed limbs across her face during the dismemberment. It was later discovered that Cindy's sister, Melanie, was on this trip with her and had no recollection of anything sinister occurring. In late June 1985, Cindy was involuntarily committed to the psychiatric unit at Vancouver's Lion Gate Hospital after having attempted suicide by overdosing on prescription drugs. Though she later said that she had not intended to kill herself. On July 2nd, she agreed to allow police to wiretap a phone conversation with Makepeace, during which she accused him of being the source of her problems and confronted him about the memory she recounted under hypnosis of him murdering two people. During the conversation, Makepeace denied the incidents, deeming Cindy insane. Following this recorded call, the RCMP employed officers to maintain a 24-hour surveillance of Cindy, Makepeace, and two other unnamed suspects over a week-long period. The surveillance was ultimately terminated after nothing unusual was observed. Now, come on. Seriously. If you have a stalker, if there's a stalker involved and you've got police parked right outside of your home, what are you gonna do? You're gonna go stalk your victim? Like is this stalker gonna come stalk you while you've got police out there? I don't think so. I mean, unless they're completely brazen and so secure with themselves that they know they're not gonna get caught. I mean, really, if you've got cops sitting outside of your home, that's going to be the time that nothing is going to take place, in my own personal opinion. That's all. So authorities further investigated Cindy's claims regarding the alleged dismemberments committed by Makepeace and found no evidence of any murders or missing person cases in the Gulf Islands at the time. Makepeace's attorney stated that the accusation led authorities on a wild goose chase, searching for the cabin location of the alleged murders, which they were unable to find. In the fall of 1985, Dr. Anthony Marcus, a psychologist, was requested by Carol Halliday of the RCMP to conduct interviews with Cindy and examine the various case files. Halliday, who had become involved with the case after reporting with a colleague at the August 21st fire incident, felt Cindy was lying and orchestrating her attacks, and that the various male officers who investigated them for her had been conned by the histrionics of a pretty woman. I'm sorry. I think that's a word I'm not familiar with. Histrionics of a pretty woman. Based on his interviews and analysis of the police records, Marcus offered his professional opinion that Cindy may have been suffering from dissociative identity disorder stemming from a traumatic childhood incident, though he did not question Cindy about her early life during the interviews. On December 1st, Cindy moved again to a new house in Richmond. 10 days later, on December 11th, at approximately 6 o'clock p.m., she was found by motorists semi-conscious in a ditch approximately 3.5 miles from her home, near the University of British Columbia campus. She was wearing a men's work boot and a single glove. And again, a nylon stocking was tightly tied around her neck due to frigid temperatures. Cindy was suffering from hypothermia and was rushed to a local hospital. So while she's at the hospital, it's suspected that she's been injected with some sort of tranquilizer. She also exhibited bruising and various cuts on her body. When interviewed in the hospital, Cindy claimed to have no memory of what occurred or how she had even gotten to the location where she had been found. Her last memory was to have lunch during her workday, after which she stopped at a local pharmacy. Upset over the feeling that police did not believe her, she flew to visit her brother Roger in West Germany for Christmas. Then, once she came back home, she stayed with her friend Cindy for several days after another fire in her home, where they noted that she refused to eat and made comments that her life was no longer worth living. And I'm sorry, we're just going to stop here for a second, because if you're being stalked and tormented and terrified, like, on a pretty constant basis, it's going to start to wear you down and it's going to start to depress you. And especially if the authorities are not believing you, like, that's going to start to depress anyone. So at this point in time, Alan Conley, a psychiatrist who had been treating Cindy since January of 1983, met with her and stated that though he had long believed her allegations of harassment, he feared she was suicidal. Conley had her committed to the psychiatric ward of St. Paul's Hospital for 2 weeks, where it was observed that she was suffering from anorexia and depression. She was subsequently transferred to Riverview Hospital, where a comprehensive psychological examination was conducted. And so this is what the report noted. The 41-year-old woman, on initial assessment, was very resistant. She would only answer in one-word responses. She refused to discuss a number of topics and would give no eye contact. On the second date, her mood was considerably elevated. She had completed the other tests herself and was willing to talk. She seemed apprehensive as to how these tests could be used. She maintained good eye contact except when discussing the terrorizing incidents. She then would look down or cover her eyes and speak hesitantly. She expressed being upset and crying a great deal when speaking about these incidents. Patient kept asking if her responses to the items indicated she was crazy. Her IQ is well above average. This type of individual can be characterized by negativistic and conforming. They have unpredictable moods, pessimism, sullenness, vacillating with social agreement and friendliness. They tend to anticipate and precipitate disappointments through their obstructive and negative behavior. This type of person tends to be vulnerable to fears. After a 10-week hospital stay, Cindy was released. According to her father, she told him that she had been withholding information regarding her alleged attacks, stating that she knew the identity of the assailant but refused to name him. On October 11th, 1988, Makepeace received two strange voicemails on his home answering machine. One of the messages contained a hoarse voice speaking the phrase, "Cindy, dead meat soon." And so I listened to this recording, and it is actually on Cindy's sister's blog, which I'll talk about here in a little bit. And I swear to goodness, this is most definitely a woman trying to disguise her voice. Like, I listened to it a few times over, and I am just certain it is a woman trying to disguise her voice. But you guys listen to that recording and let me know what you think on that, because I'm pretty sure. So over the course of nearly 7 years that Cindy had reported the various incidents, the RCMP spent an estimated $1 to $1.5 million of resources investigating her claims, but no evidence could be located to corroborate them. Because of this, authorities suspected that Cindy was inventing the incidents herself and staging them to appear as though she were the victim of a violent stalker. Cindy expressed frustration with the police department, aside from one detective, Jerry Anderson. In a complaint she filed against the RCMP for her perceived dismissal by several officers, she positively singled out Anderson for his patience, unfailing professional conduct, and his exemplary investigation of the case. "He is the one member of the RCMP I feel I can trust and be comfortable with." At approximately 4 o'clock p.m. on May 25th, 1989, Cindy picked up her paycheck from Richmond General Hospital. Then she spoke with a coworker who reported that she seemed to be in a good mood and in good spirits, and said Cindy informed her that she had not experienced any suspicious activity at her home for at least 2 weeks. Cindy was last seen several hours later purchasing groceries at a Safeway supermarket and visiting the Bank of Montreal at the Blundell Shopping Center. A bank patron told police they had stood in line behind Cindy at the bank's ATM, where she deposited her paycheck at approximately 7:59 p.m. That same day, Cindy had scheduled to have an infrared detection system installed in her home for security purposes, and had planned for her friends Agnes and Tom to play bridge and spend the night. After not hearing from Cindy, Agnes and Tom visited her home at approximately 10 o'clock p.m. and found the house locked and Cindy's car was gone. They briefly spoke with Johnston, who is a man that Cindy let move in into her basement as a tenant, and Johnston informed them that she had mentioned earlier that she was going to be doing some shopping. So her friends drove past the Blundell Shopping Center, which they knew Cindy to frequent, and found her car abandoned in the lot. They proceeded to drive around the Richmond RCMP station to report Cindy as a missing person. Though she had only been missing for several hours, a patrol car was sent to investigate based on her extensive history with the police department. Upon examination of the vehicle, blood was located inside the car on the driver's side door, as well as groceries and a wrapped birthday gift for her friend's young son. Contents from Cindy's wallet were found lying underneath the vehicle. A subsequent inspection of her home that night showed nothing had been disturbed. Police observed that the house was orderly and clean and filled with numerous well-tended houseplants. I don't know why that is a big deal, but it's noted. So the Canadian Coast Guard gets deployed, and they're searching all the rivers in the area as well as the Gulf of Georgia in an attempt to locate the missing woman. On June 8th, 1989, Gordon Starchuk, a municipal paver, he discovered Cindy's body in the backyard of an abandoned house at 8111 Blundell Road, Richmond. Her body was hogtied with rope in a fetal position, and a black nylon stocking was bound tightly around her neck. Cindy's right leg lay beneath a bunch of blackberry bushes, and her coat was found lying near her body. The property where her remains were found was situated along a busy street near an intersection which had a ton of foot traffic. On the residence exterior, like there's a fuel tank on the exterior of this house, the police found graffiti in orange spray paint reading, "Some bitch died here." And then there is a line spray painted along the ground with the same orange paint, and it ran from the fuel tank to the spot where Cindy's body was laying. And then it was encircled around her body. And inside the abandoned home, another spray painted graffiti reading, "Devil," was found. Sheila Carlisle, a pathologist who examined Cindy's body at the scene, noted that her hands had been bound so tightly that one fingernail had scratched the other finger all the way down to the bone. There was also a pinprick consistent with a hypodermic needle on her inner right elbow. Based on the insect and larva activity on the remains, forensic entomologist Gail Anderson concluded that the body had begun the decomposition process at the site where it was found as early as June 2nd, 1989. An autopsy determined that Cindy had died from multiple drug intoxication, from substantial amounts of morphine, diazepam, and flurazepam. Her body toxicology report showed that she had 10 times the lethal dose of morphine in her bloodstream. Based on an examination of her stomach contents, toxicologist Heather Dinn reported that Cindy had orally ingested approximately 20 30 milligram tablets of flurazepam, or up to 80 tablets of a higher dose, in addition to numerous tablets of diazepam, a combination that itself was lethal. The method by which the morphine had been administered could not be determined, which is baffling. Like, the pharmacologist is completely baffled by this. And the pharmacologist is analyzing the toxicology report. And so traces of morphine were found in Cindy's stomach, though Dr. John McNeil stated the amount could have resulted from intravenous injection of the drug. But McNeil's analysis, if Cindy had received morphine via intravenous injection, she would have been rendered unconscious within minutes and would have died within several hours. It was ultimately concluded by authorities that the overdose had been so large that there was no reliable estimate of how long Cindy could have remained functional. The RCMP suspected Cindy's cause of death was likely a suicide or accident, based on the assumption that she had fabricated her numerous prior claims of assault and stalking. And this was quickly reported by several local tabloid news outlets. Her personal private investigator, Caban, visited the morgue to examine her body on June 10th and observed that her remains exhibited lividity, the settling of blood post-mortem, visible on the skin, on the left side of her body. Because her body had been found lying on its right side, Caban felt she may have died elsewhere and her body was relocated to the site where it was ultimately discovered. Also, I would like to note, so Cindy's car is what, like 3 miles away, right? If Cindy had, she's barefoot. She's completely barefoot. If she had walked to wherever to torture herself and commit suicide, she would have debris on her feet. Cindy's feet were completely clean. Totally clean. The needle to inject morphine was never found. The police had a knot expert come in and hogtie themselves to see if it could be done, and the expert did it in 3 minutes. But with the amount of drugs that were in her system, she wouldn't have been functional enough to tie herself up. Now, let's just think about this for a second here. A knot expert comes in and ties himself up. He's an expert, which means he knows how to tie these knots behind his back. Okay? Cindy is not a knot expert. Cindy is an RN. She's a nurse. She's not an expert in tying knots. And I would also like to point out, let's pretend Cindy takes these drugs. She injects herself with morphine and takes all these pills. And let's pretend she's going to try and hog tie herself. How long you think she's going to be lucid to be able to get those knots tied behind her back and tied so tight that her fingernail takes another finger all the way to the bone? Or let's say she tries to tie herself up first. I'm going to get myself all hog tied. Well, then how's she going to inject a needle into her arm and how is she going to down all these pills? I can't wrap my head around that. Maybe somebody else can, and maybe somebody can explain that to me. But I have a hard time with that one. So Cindy's sister, Melanie, wrote a book. And her book is called Who Killed My Sister, My Friend? She also has a blog about Cindy. And Cindy's blog, or I'm sorry, Melanie's blog is melaniehack.com. And so I want to just read a little bit from what I found in Melanie's blog. For much of 7 years, starting in 1982, the life of my oldest sister, Cindy James, was a living hell, as though she were trapped in a horror novel from which there was no escape except in death. But this was real life. She suffered more than most of us ever will experience. I have been tormented and harassed by someone who knows me well enough to know what will really hurt me, she wrote in her living nightmare. She endured 7 major physical assaults, including kidnapping and several attempted murders, had her arms tied up tightly behind her and electrical tape sealed over her mouth, was injected with drugs, held at knife point, slashed, stabbed, sexually violated, and time after time strangled to near death with black nylon pantyhose. In addition, she was the object of harassment that included obscene and threatening phone calls, letters, and notes made of words cut from newspaper, messages left on her car windshield with a picture of a covered corpse being wheeled into a morgue on a stretcher, raw meat of small animals delivered, and dead cats left in and around her house, some with string around their necks, and a note nearby saying, "You're next." Damage to her property, broken windows, a slashed pillow, cut phone wires, and arson. Even her beloved dog, Heidi, had been found shaking with fright and sitting in her own feces, allegedly with a cord wound tightly around her neck. The harassment would appear to cease for brief periods, then return. So Cindy never knew when something horrible was going to happen. So she had to be constantly alert, careful, and watchful. In her journal, she screamed at God, "How? How could you let this go on?" But he never heard her. Or so she guessed, he never cared. During those 7 years, Cindy changed her name, repainted her car a different color, moved many times, and hired a private investigator she could hardly afford, who installed a two-way radio, alarms, and strong back porch lights at her home, plus gave her an electronic panic button. Cindy endured polygraph tests that were scientifically unreliable due to her traumatized state. She tolerated hours of stressful and draining hypnosis sessions where she recounted and relived horrific visions in an attempt to share information that her attack included amnesia had kept hidden. And she suffered a great emotional anguish from the resulting flashbacks and nightmares and became tense and afraid those nightmares or memories would overwhelm her. Her blog is actually pretty great. So if you want to check out Melanie's blog, just go to melaniehack.com. And she's got recordings on there. She's got photos on there. And then obviously she has a lot more information. I just took a little piece of it to give you a little insight into this blog. But if you remember earlier when I started talking about Patrick McBride, I told you that I have a juicy little snippet at the end of this. So this little snippet, I found it on Reddit. So you have to take it with a grain of salt because Reddit's Reddit. And we never know if it's real or if it's not real. But this Reddit story says, "The story of Cindy James, a troubled Canadian woman who died in what authorities said was suicide, but her family swears was murder. For years, Cindy reported harassing and sometimes violent incidents, including everything from dead cats left by her door to knife attacks up her you-know-what. If you believe that Cindy orchestrated her own harassment campaign, as I now do, you at least had to admire her dedication. It's somehow even scarier to imagine that she did these things to herself, ranging from fires in her apartment to beatings in the cold woods. God, if you buy that Cindy did it, you also have to believe that she beat up her own dog." And there's an edit. "Forgot to add, my uncle was a suspect and was a..." Restart. "Forgot to add that my uncle was a suspect, and what a lot of the available reading on the case files fail to mention is that years after Cindy turned up dead, my uncle, Pat McBride of the Royal Canadian Mounted Police, was stripped of his badge for what I was told were similar attacks or threats of attacks on other women. He since passed, so I can't ask him about it, though I don't think I would. He always scared me a little." So that's a pretty interesting little juicy snippet there. So I have to say, my own personal opinion, I definitely think that Cindy had a stalker, and I do think that Cindy was murdered. I also believe that she probably did have some mental issues, and they probably were stemming from having a rough childhood. And I mean, she liked to date and marry guys that were of her senior and, you know, pretty far of her senior, which, whatever, that's not a big deal. But she also liked to date and marry guys of authority and guys that like to be in control of situations. So to me, I kind of imagine this girl as kind of timid and not really knowing what to do with herself. So she's looking for somebody to tell her what to do with herself. And maybe she was attention seeking in part of this. Like maybe part of it was attention seeking, but I don't think that all of it was attention seeking. I don't know. I would love to know what your theory is on this case. So please, please send me an email. Let me know what you think. And that is all for today, Misfits. Thanks, guys. Bye. Thanks for joining, Misfits. Don't forget to like, share, and subscribe. After all, mystery loves company.